Have you noticed? Cocktails are all the rage. On this beautiful Friday, we sidle up to the bar to learn more. Cocktail mania has been sweeping the nation, and Maine is caught up in the trend. There is even a word for an expert bartender who comes up with new and creative cocktails: a mixologist. A recent Nielsen CGA consumer poll revealed that 23% of Americans have drunk a cocktail outside of the home in the past 3 months, and that the average price for a cocktail is almost $9, even more for premium spirits. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will tap into this trend. We'll find out a little about the history of cocktails, classic cocktails, what mixologists are putting into the newer drinks. Do you have a favorite recipe to share, a favorite ingredient for your cocktail? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Americans spend $50 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars a year on alcohol. The majority of those dollars are spent on beer and wine, but hard alcohol sales are on the rise, and it's in part because of the popularity of cocktails. Today on Maine Calling, we are going to learn about the history of cocktails, the scene here in Maine, and how to make a classic cocktail. In the studio with me, Maggie Campbell. She is head distiller at Privateer Rum and currently a Master's of Wine student. Steve Corman is co-owner of Vina's Fizz House. And Ned White is founder and distiller at New England Distilling in Portland, Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. What is your favorite cocktail? What's the weirdest drink you've ever tried? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. You know, I have to confess, I haven't thought much about cocktails before preparing for today's program, but I did start thinking, how did cocktails get started? Were there always cocktails? Or is this something that there's a history that people study and we know where it came from? I'm going to start with you, Steve. What do you know about the history of the whole idea of a cocktail?
Well, Maine was a rum society, you know, way back in the 1700s. They got cane sugar and they were distilling, and there was a problem, you know, by the 1800s with Mayor Dow just killing all alcohol consumption, because you could go to any hairdresser, barbershop, supermarket. There weren't any supermarkets but groceries, and there would be urns of rum for a nickel apiece. So how did that go into the world of cocktails? We became a rye society, and Ned can talk about that later, before there was bourbon, and putting a drop of water, would that be a cocktail? No. But taking a really, you know, vigorous, botanical, hard rye, putting a drop of water in it would open it up. I used bitters the same way. Then sweet vermouth came on, you know, and then they started making Manhattans. But the bitters really
When you
started,
say they started making Manhattans, they is who? In the United States?
Okay.
Or did this start in Europe? Cuba, I mean.
So, Jennifer, we were getting imports from beautiful wines from Italy, and we were getting wines when California wasn't around then making wine. So we're getting it from Italy, and some of these wines were, you know, just fortified. And that's what a vermouth is. It's fortified wine. So they're taking bourbon and rye and putting in a little fortified wines, sweet vermouth, and that was the beginning of a Manhattan. That's all Manhattan is. Two parts whiskey, one part sweet vermouth.
All right. So many drinks can be traced back to, I know so many foods can be traced back to a particular chef or a particular restaurant. Mm-hmm. Ned, are there drinks that we trace back to a hotel lobby or an author who's written about them?
Yeah, there's a lot of history about each individual cocktail, where they're born and things like that. And there's like the Sazerac is sort of a famous cocktail from New Orleans. And one of the key ingredients is the Peychaud's bitters, which comes to, I believe, a pharmacist, correct?
Yes.
Is that right, Meg?
So, I believe he was a Creole pharmacist.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. And so these things, they go back, like the story of one of the other original cocktails is what's called the old fashioned, right? Classic cocktail. Booze, sugar, bitters. And some people argue the original cocktail I've heard that that sort of originated in a bar in Kentucky, but yeah, that's those between those two. That's what I've heard is the original cocktails and their exact origin. I think in the case of the Sazerac is relatively well known. I don't know that the old fashioned is, but yeah, they all it goes back to different bartenders that worked at hotels. What's the bartender's guide from the 18th Harry?
Yeah.
Craddock or something, yeah. I want to say. But, you know, they do have origin from individual bartenders and things like that. But the closer we get to the current time, the better we're able to nail that down, like with tiki and things like that.
And you
like
were
that.
About to say the bartender's guide from the 18-somethings,
boy.
Because I was going to say to you, Maggie, yeah. I was going to ask, when I think of cocktails in their heyday, I'm thinking of the Roaring Twenties, but we're talking way earlier
way
than that.
Way earlier. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's some controversy between, you know, what's a mixed drink and what's a cocktail. But for me, you know, the grog invented by, you know, sort of sailing culture. Water would spoil in a barrel on a ship. I mean, we're talking way back. And so they would drink rum. And rum was a ration in the Navy. And, you know, to avoid scurvy, they would put lime in it. And if you were a very good friend, you might get some sugar from your sailing voyages. And then eventually, you know, maybe some spices. And so we're talking about really the first time you're seeing someone mix a spirit, which is considered like a utility. You know, it purifies water. It definitely made colonial era culture a little bit more bearable for some people who had access to it. And, you know, this is really the beginning of people beginning to add ingredients and drink for pleasure. And they would water down the rum on the deck of the ship. And that was sort of, you know, when I think of a cocktail, introducing ice or dilution is such a huge part of bringing out the character, as you guys discussed. You really kind of start to see people understanding how spirits work in a drink, playing around with it. You know, the purser, who was the person who put the rum and portioned it for all the different sailors, kind of became the first mixologist, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And there's a great book written by Wayne Curtis, who actually worked at the newspaper here in Portland and is a journalist from this area. And he wrote And a Bottle of Rum. And it kind of talks about those early cocktails and then how it developed throughout history and different recipes and different people who've all shaped, particularly rum, which, of course, has huge roots here in Maine.
Okay, well, let's talk about that a little bit because Portland, you know, is well known as being the birthplace of the temperance movement. And I have always thought there's probably a reason that the temperance movement, you know, grew out of Portland. It's clear that there weren't only positive effects of Portland being one of the centers of the rum enthusiasm at the end of the 1800s.
We named Vina's Fizz House after my wife's great-grandmother, Irvina Johnson, who's buried in Evergreen Cemetery here in Portland. In 1920, she was one of the leaders of the Maine Christian temperance movement, vehemently anti-alcohol. And we were in the throes of, you know, prohibition at that time. But there was a lot of people from 1860 through the 1930s here in Maine that vehemently hated what alcohol did to society.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what you all do. Ned, tell me about your distillery. Where did you get the idea? How did you decide as a young person in Maine to start a distillery?
Yeah.
What did you see? What kind of opportunity?
Well, it had always been something on my mind. I've got a lot of family history in distilling. My family's from Maryland and started distilling down there in the 1860s, making rye whiskey. So it's something that I always grew up hearing about, you know, talking about just family history. And then in college, I got into craft beer and then producing beer, and then that got a little out of hand at home, so I needed to do it for fun and for profit. So I got into the professional brewing industry, starting early on at Allagash. And once I got into actual production, I loved it. It was just a great industry. It draws a great group of people. It's creative, and I knew it was something I wanted to do forever. And so ultimately was able to pull things together to move out on my own and start the distillery. And so we started in 2011, 2012, and we've been going strong ever since.
So we're having this program today on cocktails. How do you feel about your spirits being mixed with something else?
It's the greatest.
Really?
Yeah,
you don't
it really
think,
is.
Oh, you're not a purist. Is that people aren't supposed
no,
to have
them? No, not at all. One of the things I love, and it's I think is somewhat unique to, you know, certainly in, you know, the alcohol industry, is with spirits. Like with beer, you're making a finished product, right? You put a beer in a keg and someone goes to the bar or restaurant and that beer is transferred right into a glass as the person expects it, as the brewer made it. With spirits, that happens sometimes with some spirits, but a lot of times it's almost like you're making a finished product to me that I then hand off to another creative who then uses it as an ingredient, you know, in their own unique creation, which I think is very cool. I'm very proud of our finished product on its own and love seeing the additional creativity that people, you know, extend beyond what we've done.
Do you feel the same way, Maggie?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, absolutely. And in anyone's hands, you know, I'm fortunate to make something that, you know, because it's sort of a specialty foodie good, people are typically enjoying it when they're celebrating or having a good evening out with friends or sharing it, you know, with other people they care about. And so it's really exciting to be a part of that. And I always get asked, you know, do you get upset if someone mixes it with Coke or Moxie or something? And I'm like, absolutely not. Like, I make it and I love what I make, but it's kind of like in a very small way and obviously not the same, but like raising children. And once you have kind of, you know, brought up this spirit in the cellar and matured it and you release it, it's not really mine anymore to tell anyone what to do. And they get to experience and it becomes theirs and they get to have a great time with it and smile and enjoy. And so for me, I'm really excited to see what everyone's doing with it. Things I never would have thought of. They bring out flavors I never even knew were there. And it's really, really exciting. And it's all about, you know, creating something new and adding value and using skill to create something more than the sum of its parts. And it's cool to be a part of that.
I'm still trying to get over you saying rum and Moxie. Oh. So I'm going to sit over here in shock and say to you, Steve, does a cocktail have to have alcohol to be a cocktail?
Well, we at Venus Fizz House started for the first 20 months without any alcohol. Now, I don't believe anyone's ever tried that, but we were profiting. So for it to be a true cocktail, yes, you need alcohol. We call our non-alcoholic drinks mocktails, fizzes. We have cream sodas, phosphates, which is an old-fashioned feel for a soda. Whether I say it's my opinion that people are missing the boat on the non-alcoholic drinks in America, we are just growing and growing in that. It's a major part of our business. Now, we're a bar, but we don't sell cheap beer. We have 3 beer cocktails on our menu right now where I'm using Allagash White with gin, using Sebago's Frieslee IPA with mezcal, and I'm using Lone Pine Pale Ale with tequila. Now, I'm a beer purist. I drink IPA. I really don't drink cocktails, but I had Southern Pines, a tequila Lone Pine Pale Ale. The other night, I had a third of a cocktail. It was a beer cocktail. I could be a cocktail drinker, but hallelujah, at my age, I love my beer, and I'm never going to be a really true cocktail drinker.
I want to ask all of you, though, why are cocktails, in your view, having their day in the sun? I mean, Ned, is this a trend like gourmet cupcakes, or is this something else?
I think it's something else. I mean, maybe it's the same. I haven't thought a whole lot about the gourmet cupcake industry, but I think it's part of the overall rediscovery of food by our society. I mean, you know, it's a rediscovery of quality ingredients and what you can do with them, and so I feel strongly that we're going to see cocktails continue to work their way into restaurants that they're, you know, that haven't necessarily embraced a modern cocktail program. And I think it's going to continue to pervade and grow, which I think is fantastic.
Okay. And I'll ask you the same question, Maggie.
Yeah, absolutely. I know a lot of, you know, particularly, well, I guess millennials aren't that young anymore. They're like 37, 38 now. But
that's young.
It's very young. But yeah, being a kind of a part of that generation, you know, a lot of people are learning to love to drink at home and staying in with their friends and, you know, buying a couple ingredients, having a little cocktail bar at home, a little cocktail cart, having friends over for a big bowl of punch. I mean, it's cool to see people drinking really well at home and then going out to fine dining. I think it's become, you know, part of the meal, part of the experience. And, you know, it was a very recent thing in some ways, prohibition, wiping out cocktails. They're something that we're always here and have been here. And I think that it's just sort of that return to, you know, crafting something and working with simple and beautiful ingredients that bring complexity of flavors and sort of these trends in food and in wine that are happening as well, kind of complementing it. And I don't think it's something that'll fizzle out in the 14 years that I've been, you know, in this industry. It's been thrilling to see how it's taken off and how people have embraced it. And, you know, meeting people who are very intimidated to make their first simple syrup. And now I go over to their house and they have like a fully stocked bar. And it's really exciting and it's fun. And it's, yeah, it's definitely a part of this whole sort of foodie drinks culture.
Okay. Well, you mentioned at home. Before we go to our break, we've got a couple minutes. I want to ask each of you, if someone's listening, they've never made a cocktail except maybe something gin and tonic, give us a quick and easy recipe for a beginner. Steve, you go first.
Okay. I do this for my profession. 1.5 to 2 ounces of any spirit, 0.5 to 1 ounce of any type of sweetener, simple syrup. And it could be an amaro, which is a potable bitter that is sweet, like liqueurs. And 1 ounce of a citrus, squeeze lime or lemon. And a quality bitter to bring it all together, to enhance flavors, to give flavors, and give it the complexity that you're saying beautifully.
Okay, your turn, Ned.
We'll stick with the main cocktail. It's an old fashioned, so it couldn't be simpler. I'd go with 1.5 to 2 ounces of a aged rum or a whiskey. Go with maybe half teaspoon to 1 of maple syrup. And then a couple dashes of bitters, and then a little zest of lemon. You're in business.
Maine maple syrup, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Maggie?
Rum Boulevardier. So
fancy name.
Yeah, fancy name. You get to sound really, really, like, professional. And it's very, very simple. It's equal parts sweet vermouth, Campari, and an aged rum. You stir it with ice, strain it into a glass, you're done.
All right. Well, on that note, we are going to take a break. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do WEX, providing global payment solutions for the fleet, travel, and health industries. Career opportunities at WEXINC.com. And the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to the public. Maine Public is teaming up with Darlings and Literacy Volunteers of Bangor to share the joy of reading with children across Maine. Many Maine children have limited access to appropriate books, so Maine Public is collecting new books and pristine used books at Darlings and Maine Public locations. These books will be distributed at many of the Darlings Ice Cream for a Cause stops and also at two special literacy events, including this Saturday from 11 to 2 at Darlings Chrysler Dodge Ram Hyundai dealership at 439 Western Avenue in Augusta. The event will include Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz, who will read to children photo opportunities with Clifford the Big Red Dog, the Darlings Ice Cream for a Cause truck, and other fun activities. For more information and all the details, including how to donate books, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, it is the cocktail hour. Joining me in our studio, Steve Corman, co-owner of Venus Fizz House, Ned White, founder and distiller at New England Distilling, Maggie Campbell, head distiller at Privateer Rum and currently a Master's of Wine student. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet @MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page, you may be able to hear that there's a little mixology happening in the studio as we speak. Thank you to Steve. Maggie, you know, at the beginning of the program, I didn't ask you, is it Campbell or Campbell?
Campbell.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. So we already have a whole bunch of tweets and Facebook posts coming in. And I'll start with you, Maggie. Nick on Twitter says, two questions for Maggie. What's it like being a female distiller? What attracted you to rum? It's too sweet to me.
Well, the idea that rum is sweet is kind of a myth because of the modern style. Anything that is distilled comes off a still clear and dry. So it's only sweet if sweetener has been added back to it before bottling. We don't sweeten any of our rums. Our rums are as dry as any whiskey. Having kind of started in the whiskey industry, it's very important to me to have that kind of dry, crisp taste, all the layers of flavor. And I can often joke that, you know, sugar can hide a magnitude of sins. So for us, we don't have anything covering our rum. You can taste everything we've done, and it's got a lot of flavor there. But that is definitely something we hear a lot. Being a woman in the industry is interesting. I mean, women have always been a part of distilling, and they are a part of distilling, but it's mostly a visibility issue. You know, Appleton is headed up by a woman. Ron Zacapa is headed up by a woman. Rachel Berry, who is an amazing Scotch whiskey blender, Ardbeg, Bowmore. I mean, you've tasted these women's work. Hendrick's Gin by Leslie. I think there's a lot of really incredible women throughout my industry, but it doesn't kind of fit in with the sort of caricature storyline we have. So I'm lucky to have so many incredible female peers, but it is still kind of a perception issue. My husband is also a distiller, and when people meet us, they're often like, oh, so you're the head distiller of Privateer Rum to him. And it's kind of funny and kind of interesting and also can be annoying.
I'm sure. Okay, Steve, what have you been up to over there on the other side of the studio?
Okay.
By that cooler?
I'm going to mix up a called Passion in the Woods. I'm using pine simple syrup. We're in the Pine Tree State with passion fruit simple syrup, lemon, and an alpiner bitter that's full of wormwood. It's a wormwood base. I'm going to shake it up. And then I'm going to add seltzer, and I'm taking off. I'm going to be in, not around for 30 seconds.
Okay.
I can smell it from here. It smells amazing.
On that note, an email from Mike. A cocktail composed of Bacardi and Moxie is named for the question the first sip often provokes. Jamaica mistake? I like that. We're going to go to Tyler, who's calling from Portland. If I can get my computer to click. There we go. Tyler, hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just heard your recipe for an old fashioned, and I wanted to note that after having an old fashioned, a bartender offered to me a new fashioned that was her own creation, and I'd like to share the recipe with you if you want.
Go right ahead, as long as it's not too complicated. It's Friday.
No, it's very simple. Very simple. I don't know my ounces, but you start with a pint glass and put in two fingers, maybe a touch more of ginger liqueur, muddle a slice of orange in it, fill it with ice, fill the pint glass with ice, and then Maker's Mark. Shake that all up, strain it, and it's absolutely fantastic. Garnish with a slice of orange or some cherries.
Thank you. And you were nodding, Maggie.
Yeah. I love ginger in a drink. I think it tastes amazing. It very much complements whiskeys. I dig it. Sounds good.
Okay,
yeah.
And we'll have this
email. I think it's great, and I just want to throw out that the worst drink I've ever had was a burnt trailer. Moxie and Allen's coffee brandy.
I just think Moxie does not belong. It just does not belong mixed with anything. Alcoholic, someone can correct me there. Ooh, thanks, Tyler. Let's see here. We have an email from Greg. We're going to, Ned, let you try this one. What's the recipe for Nelson's Blood? Is that something you know about?
I do not know the recipe for that one. I think the story behind it, I think I can fight my way through that one. Do either of you guys know the recipe to answer that part?
I don't know the recipe.
Okay.
I've heard of it. I don't know the recipe.
So generally speaking, I think Nelson's Blood is another reference to rum. And correct me, somebody, if I'm wrong, but the story goes to Admiral Lord Nelson, who I think in the battle, we'll say Trafalgar because that's the battle that comes to mind, was killed on deck. And they wanted to return his body, so they stuffed him in a rum barrel and to preserve him on deck because, as Maggie said, that was part of the Navy ration. And I believe it was a rum barrel when he went in, a full rum barrel. And then by the time they made it to port, it was an empty rum barrel.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Well, so, thank you, Greg, for the email. Okay, so now we have our drinks in front of us. And this is a mocktail, right?
It's a fizz. Mocktails we put in cocktail glasses. So,
okay. This is a fizz. And this is Passion in the Woods?
Passion in the Woods.
Interesting.
The first sense you get is the sweetness from the passion. Then it immediately goes to the wormwood's reaction with the pine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what delicious. Bitters do. It has a layering effect. It will also mix and also flavor and enhance.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing. Anybody else want to add your expert description of what it...
It's really refreshing.
It is refreshing would be the good word.
Yeah. It's refreshing. It has a lot of finesse. You know, it's sometimes things can be really refreshing and kind of like snappy and harsh, but this has a lot of finesse too. I think it's the bitters and the Amaro.
Definitely the bitters, and if you add Ingenium dry gin and add another bitter to it, it just in Jonathan M. Woodward's last day here can attest to that because he's had a few of those.
Ingenium gin is being brought up because, Ned, it is one of your products, correct?
It is. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yes.
We'll go to Susan calling from Camden. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling. Susan, are you there? No? Okay. Hopefully, if you've missed this, you can call us back, Susan. We'll go to Veronica on Facebook. She posts... While in Italy, I was served a frozen limoncello after dinner, almost like a slushy. I've tried to recreate this and haven't been able to. Any suggestions?
You know, I know the exact person who can answer this. and his Twitter handle is at Kodiak Daiquiri, if you want to go for that. But I imagine... A way to do it would possibly be to put it in the freezer because the alcohol content will keep it from freezing thoroughly. And then kind of trying to mash it up with a spoon when you pull it out as opposed to doing it as a blended drink. The blended drink would probably agitate it a little too much and liquefy it a little too far. So I'm imagining they might have used an ice shaver and put the limoncello over the top. But to recreate it at home without like a fancy ice shaver, I think you could probably try putting some limoncello in the freezer and seeing if it kind of half freezes for you.
Martha on Facebook says, A favorite summer drink is pink lemonade margarita, 2 ounces good silver tequila, 2 ounces Grand Marnier. Frozen concentrate pink lemonade made to specifications on can minus a half can of water and directions. Ice. Favorite part is rimming the glass with equal parts of salt and sugar. 1 drop of red food coloring for a pink touch. Everybody's shaking their head in here, Martha. Mix the concentrate in the pitcher. Add ice, tequila, and Grand Marnier and fill with lemonade. Very refreshing. And you should know Martha posted this on our Facebook page. So if you're quick writing notes, you don't need to. Just go to our Facebook page. But you guys say no food coloring.
Yeah.
Just people should drink what they like.
Right.
And they should
Absolutely.
Have fun. And, you know, everyone's got their own tastes. I'm kind of with you on the food coloring. Like, just let the color be. But, you know, let people have fun.
Yeah. It doesn't hurt anything. But if it hits the color that you want, go to town.
Yeah.
There's some crazy looking cocktails out there color wise. So.
One of the things I was really surprised to learn when I was doing my reading this morning from this Nielsen CGA consumer survey of last year is that the most popular liquor base for cocktails in the U.S. is tequila.
Yeah. Margaritas are huge, especially on premise in restaurants. I mean, they're huge. My personal favorite margarita recipe is fresh lime, just juice it right in the glass, a little bit of Grand Marnier. If you need a little bit of sweetener, you could use a little simple syrup and then just a nice tequila, stir it over ice, leave it in the glass on rocks. That's how I personally drink them. I know that might not be the most perfect recipe for them, but when I'm at home after a long day in a hot distillery and I feel like drinking something like that, that's usually what we do. We use like tequila ocho or if we're feeling really crazy, like a Del Maguey Vita Mezcal.
We have an email from Todd, Maine's own split Rock Distilling makes an unbelievably delicious organic blueberry vodka that tastes even better than it sounds when mixed with ice-cold lemonade. Everybody's nodding in here. Mira on Facebook says, listening to your show while drinking ice water and wanted to recommend a great simple syrup company here in Maine, Royal Rose by husband and wife mixologist team, Emily Butters and Forrest Butler. They're superb. Everybody here nodding and giving me the thumbs up as well. From our very own John Keimel, be sure to stamp out malaria. Consume your quinine for the good of public health, palatable with gin, lime, and ice. Thoughts?
Vina's Fizz House is a retail store, so we sell simple syrups, shrubs, bitters, accoutrements, everything for cocktails and mocktails. Royal Rose of Brunswick, Maine is a mostly organic simple syrup company. Beautiful, and we sell a lot and we use it in the bar. For margaritas,
yes.
I want to get involved in that.
Please do.
We have an infusion of blueberries, apple, lime with 1800 Reposado tequila. We use a couple ounces of that with. We use dry curacao, that is deep red orange with cognac, with pine simple syrup that's in that drink, lime, two different bitters, a blueberry bitter from Union, Maine. Jennifer, Union, Maine, Sweetgrass Farms. They're farmers. They create beautiful spirits in bitters, blueberry bitters.
And wines.
Yeah.
And dry curacao is my favorite to have in a margarita. It's
good,
so
good. Good. Yeah.
An email from David. Gin Ricky with Hendrix. Gin, juice of half a lime, club soda, and a highball. And David wants us to talk about glassware. Does it matter, Ned?
It does for a couple of reasons. One, presentation, and presentation is everything, right? How it arrives, you know, is going to set your expectation. But then depending on what you're drinking, it absolutely comes into play. I mean, when you're starting to play with things like particularly alcohols, because alcohol is volatile. And so it's evaporating off and it's bringing with it flavors and aromas. And depending on the shape of the glass, that's going to concentrate aromas at your nose or allow them to drain off so you don't get the alcoholic punch. So different cocktails, different glassware. You can pay attention to it and make a wonderful cocktail, or you can serve it up in a solo cup and have a delicious cocktail.
So. Okay, we're going to go to Andrew calling from Portland. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. It seems like bartending and distilling to me are both trades and, you know, things that people learn from other people. I just had a question for all the panel. You know, can you tell us a little bit about some of your mentors out there professionally, people that you've learned from? I'd love to hear some of those stories.
Absolutely. I always tell people who are interested in learning to go and talk to a lot of different people. When I started 14 years ago, there weren't online forums. There weren't a lot of resources. And I'm really thankful for that. I was lucky enough to be in Denver, Colorado, and I was working in a specialty wine and spirit shop. I started going around and meeting my local distillers. This was after a trip I took to Scotland that really ignited an interest back in 2004. And I was lucky enough to meet Jake Norris, who was the founding distiller of Stranahan's, and Todd Leopold of Leopold Brothers. And they have taught me so much. They've remained incredibly close friends. I was lucky enough then to go work at Germain Robin, so working under a fifth-generation cognac distiller, Hubert Germain Robin. And I keep in touch with him very regularly, I'd say every other week. And then, you know, I've learned a ton from the German distillers in the Black Forest. You know, there's over 1,000 registered distillers in this tiny area sharing centuries worth of knowledge. You know, here in the U.S., Prohibition really did knock down a lot of our, you know, oral history and shared education of crafting spirits. And we're kind of starting over at ground zero. And we don't have to. We can learn from other cultures, from other people who've been distilling forever. At our distillery, one of the most important things we do is we do shadow days. So other distillers come and work with us for a day, and they can see everything that we do, and we get to learn from them, and they learn from us. And we've had, you know, a distiller come from Kenya and talk to us about distilling there, which completely changed the way we thought about water and how we use it. We've had someone from Israel come who presses cane in their own backyard. We've had someone come from Melbourne who also made rum. It's just been a really great way to keep that exchange of knowledge going. I would say the internet, particularly right now, can be somewhat hazardous way to learn. I'll see something online on a forum and I'll be like, that looks incredibly dangerous. And I'll call one of my mentors and I'll say, I saw this. This looks incredibly dangerous. And they're like, absolutely don't do that. That's insane. It's so unsafe. And then I'll go visit a couple distilleries and I'll see that they Googled that and they didn't know the difference and they're using it and it's dangerous. So I really, really caution people about learning stuff online, on forums, particularly from other people who haven't been distilling that long. Distilling, you know, is a really long-term educational project. I've been doing it 14 years and I'm still learning stuff all the time. If someone is also new at it, it can be the blind leading the blind, and it's serious stuff. So you want to make sure you learn from the right places.
All right, Steve, who are your mentors?
Jennifer, I was a teacher for 19 years, and I got a pink slip during my 19th year. I never made a drink in my life. My wife creates Venus Fizz House. I then am thrown into a bar setting for the first time in my life. I'm self-taught. I went to YouTube videos how to be a bartender.
Doing exactly what Maggie just said not
bartending
to do.
Bartending and distilling are very different.
I'm not a distiller. I'm not a distiller. I produce bitters. I make bitters. I create cocktails. Why? I have a palette for bitters. I'm using over 200 different bitters in my bar. Bitters are the forefront of any drink that we make.
So we almost need to go to break. When we come back from the break, I'm going to ask you about bitters. But Ned, who are your mentors? Your family?
That was really the impetus for coming in. I mean, my grandfather was the last one in the family to distill, so a lot of that knowledge was sort of lost. But for me, coming from the brewing world, I mean, I started off learning a lot from Rob Todd at Allagash in my early days, and then went to a lot of schooling, Siebel Institute in Chicago for brewing, and then same with distilling. I just picked up as many classes as I could, traveled to Michigan and Massachusetts and California and all over trying to pick up classes, get hands-on experience with distilling for exactly the reasons that Maggie pointed out, rather than muddle my way through in the barn and pay for it for a couple of days personally and think, don't do that again.
Okay, actually learn.
We are going to take that break. When we come back, we're going to learn about bitters. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Mount Desert Island Ice Cream, artisanal handcrafted ice cream with locations in Bar Harbor and Portland, and Bay Chamber Concerts, committed to enriching communities with high-quality musical performances in Midcoast Maine. Learn more at baychamberconcerts.org.
It's a disease that's probably been around for thousands of years, but in the decades since it was identified here in New England, Lyme disease has taken hold.
It's the type of disease that we don't have a magic bullet answer for. There's no one thing that we do that can stop it.
On Next, from the New England News Collaborative, we'll talk with a doctor who's been trying to track the history and possible future treatments for Lyme. Please join us.
Join us for Next, coming up in about 20 minutes here on Maine Public Radio.
What if we did a show about every third rail? Race.
For white people to talk about race, some of them, least favorite subject.
Politics. Abortion.
I don't think that the political conversation about abortion will ever go away.
Yep, we are going there.
It's not enough to tolerate people.
And asking, is tolerance enough?
We need to need people who are not like us.
That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us for the TED Radio Hour coming up tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock and Wednesday evening at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, cocktails and mixology. With me in our studio, Ned White, the founder and distiller at New England Distilling. Steve Corman is known as the bitterest man in the world. He is co-owner of Venus Fizz House. And Maggie Campbell is head distiller at Privateer Rum. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Here's your chance, Steve. Explain to us, what is a bitter anyway?
Okay. Bitters 101. Where people in the world of culinary, whether you're baking or cooking, is using salt, pepper, herbs, and spice, people in a cocktail or mocktail setting use bitters the same way. Now, what are bitters? They're herbs and spices, salts and peppers. They're botanicals. Botanicals include fruits, rinds of fruits, charred rinds of fruits, and they're an infusion normally in grain alcohol for 2 weeks and then bottled. There is three companies that I know of immediately right now that produce non-alcoholic bitters that are water glycerin-based. So the glycerol is a preservative, wherein all the other bitters, there's over 400 bitter companies in America, small batch, use ethanol. The alcohol is a preservative. Bitters will last forever as long as you close them up and put them in a dry, not heated place.
Okay. Learn something new every day.
So adding to that, one of the things I love reading about this stuff, I was reading recently, it was just where bitters come from is their medicine. So that's they were the herbal tinctures, you know, that was the medicine cabinet that you would go to, was you'd go and rifle through all these things, and they'd be, you know, in alcohol because you can extract the chemicals and it's a preservative. But that's how it started off as medicine, you know, and also how it wound up in cocktails as to kind of help you settle through your evenings, prior evenings indiscretions.
So in 1860, there were 350 small batch bitter companies in America, all for medicine. This is before 1905 when the USDA started the pharmacies. The pharmacies cut most of the bitter production, producers, and Prohibition killed everybody else except for Peychaud's of New Orleans. And we won't get into
that. Yeah. For me at home, just grabbing a couple cans of club soda at the market, keeping them in the fridge cold, waking up, cracking one open, putting a couple dashes of bitters in, it's delicious. It's like a little homemade soda.
Katie on Facebook says, big shout out to locally made delicious liqueurs such as Wiggly Bridge, liquors such as Wiggly Bridge Distilling in York. Their flavors are smooth and delicious. And the people who are tweeting, Maggie, they like you. Dylan on Twitter has questions for you. One, what do you think of the modern tiki cocktail scene? And two, where do you see rum in 10 years?
Oh, yeah.
What is the modern tiki cocktail scene? I feel very unhip right now, by the way.
Well, it's kind of like this ironic unhip thing that's hip to love, which is what I love about it. So one of the things I love about rum. So originally I started in the whiskey industry. And I loved it, but I felt like it was a little competitive and there was like a lot of pressure there. Went to the cognac world making brandy in Northern California, and it's very serious, and I appreciate that. But one of the things I love about rum, the writers, the characters, they're amazing. And Tiki's part of that. I mean, no one can be that much of a macho person in a Hawaiian shirt. So Tiki culture is the Hawaiian shirts, the giant Tiki mugs, the blue cocktails, you know, the crazy bars from that we know from the 20s and the 30s and the 50s and the 60s, and Trader Vic's, Don the Beachcomber. And I love modern tiki. It's fun. It's one of the most creative and visually stunning aspects of cocktail culture right now. The entire room is your garnish, I once heard said, and it really spoke to me. And the drinks are all about balance. You know, we think of them as these overly sweet, overly ridiculous style cocktails. But modern tiki is very balanced. There's a lot of citrus and acidity and dryness in some of these. And there's so many cool spirits and historical revival products coming out to use as ingredients for these traditional drinks that are really, really amazing. And it's just all about fun. And that's, you know, something I'm really passionate about, is just having a good time and relaxing and being able to laugh, but still enjoy like delicious, layered, complex flavors. So that's how I feel about tiki, and it's amazing. Potions of the Caribbean is an amazing tiki book. It's kind of a tome, and when I first saw it, I was like, oh my gosh, I can't read it. But then I got into it, and I killed it in a weekend. It's amazing.
Okay, we're going to go to Camden and Greg. Hi, Greg. Go ahead.
Greetings. I've enjoyed flipping through Mr. Boston and just looking at all the different cocktail recipes that are there, and one realizes that you can almost mix anything together. So there's quite a bit of freedom in what you can do. I've enjoyed especially high citrus drinks, but this spring for fun, I juiced some rhubarb, and I've never seen it used as an ingredient, and it was a fun platform, especially with rum. It needs some kind of sweetener, and you can go all over from triple sec to simple syrups and so forth, but it was a unique flavor. And so I urge you to play around with rhubarb juice.
It's a great one.
But my question, I've been gifted any number of bottles of really lovely gins, dry gins, you know, like St. George and Sipsmith and so forth, that are very floral. And what's the best use of that gin? I don't want to bury those flavors. So that's my question to you. Thank you.
Ned, thoughts?
Best use is a tough one to answer. It's what's
How
best
about
for
some
you?
Good uses?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy gin neat. So if it's a nice floral gin, enjoy it neat. But also, I'm a strong proponent that that good gin makes a great cocktail. So no one should feel that just because it's a special gin that it can't be mixed in with a cocktail. That's just going to elevate the drink. So go to town, make a gin and tonic with it. Buy some nice tonic, make your own tonic. There's a great Southside cocktail where you can bring in gin, some mint, some fresh squeezed lime or lemon juice, and probably something else I'm forgetting, simple syrup. And you have a delicious cocktail for the back deck. And if you're using a great floral gin, it's going to make a beautiful cocktail.
Greg, thanks for your call. We're going to move on to Yarmouth and Carolyn. Hi, Carolyn. Go ahead.
Hi. I was listening earlier, and you were talking about frozen drink with limoncello. Well, like most Italians, I keep my limoncello in the freezer, and it does not freeze.
They're all nodding. And I think that people are really interested in limoncello because we have a Facebook post from Tree Spirits, limoncello slush. Putting it in freezer will make it very cold but not slushy. You might want to add some water to it and experiment with amounts. So thank you, Carolyn. We're going to move on so we can get to some more calls here. We'll go to an email from Mike. It says, Jennifer, Moxie goes great with gin. I'm never going to hear the end of this. What do you think, Ned?
I believe there's actually a rye whiskey and mocktail and Moxie drink called the New Englander. It's got gentian as the base, and that's the base for Angostura bitters as well. So it's they were made for each other.
Okay, we've got from Aurora an email listening to your show today. Very interesting. When I make strawberry jam, I skim off the sugar foam as the jam cooks. I use that in my lime Ricky, lime simple syrup, bourbon, or whiskey tonic. It is spectacular.
Yeah, jams are a great ingredient to throw in a shaker and add flavor and richness and texture and sweetness to a cocktail. The cocktail book Spritz has one of my favorite cocktails. It's all about low alcohol Italian afternoon drinks, and one of them calls for peach jam, and I had never thought of doing that, and I love it.
That's okay, great. Let's go to Nick in Portland. Hi, Nick, go ahead.
Yes, so Portland and Maine is a very beer country. Most people have been on a brewery tour and understand the basics of the process, but many of my friends, when I try to get them into cocktails, they're kind of, oh, I don't do that, that's different, they don't know much, but both Ned and Maggie, you both have backgrounds in beer, and I was wondering if you could talk about some of the similarities and differences between distilling and brewing.
Yeah. I have a background in beer. My husband and I actually were brewing partners originally. We founded the Denver Brewers League, and beer brewing is a part of distilling because you absolutely have to ferment the base sugars before you distill it, but it's only like brewing for about 5 days. And then it's all about the distilling for a couple more days. And then actually when it's aging in barrel and you're doing all of the tasting of barrels and selecting and blending components, it can be a lot like traditional sour beers and how those blends are created, or wines. It's the same exact process. Yeah. So there's definitely a lot shared there and on a lot of the flavors and complexity.
And when you're getting to the grain-based spirits like gins and whiskeys, it's very much like beer. I mean, we make a beer first, unhopped. The distillery, and I know a lot of other distillers do this as well, they use brewer's grains, brewer's yeasts, and just like with the beers, the flavors of those unique grains and yeast will translate all the way through to the finished spirit, and they can be very beer-like as well. Yeah, similar and different.
All right. Well, to all three of you, thank you so much. We have to leave a little bit early this hour, so I just want to say thank you for being here on this beautiful Friday. Ned White, founder and distiller at New England Distilling in Portland, Maine. Maggie Campbell, head distiller at Privateer Rum and currently a Masters of Wine student. And Steve Corman, co-owner of Vina's Fizz House. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Sam Dearen took your calls. Jonathan Woodward This is his last day of running the board for Maine Calling before he heads off to graduate school. So we wish him a fond farewell. He's been a great addition to the Maine Calling team, not only running the board, but also helping produce a number of shows, including today's. We will miss his enthusiasm and his love of all things public radio, but look forward to tracking his future success. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Key Largo, Montego, Montego.